This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Well, it's happening. The days are getting shorter, heavier coats are emerging, but this winter is shaping up to be unlike any other. As coronavirus cases soar, many Americans are hunkering down for a long hibernation. We'll get into what this means for the holidays in a moment, but first, what happens to the industries that have survived by moving outdoors? To discuss, we have Amanda Cohen, owner and chef of Dirt Candy. That's a vegetarian restaurant in New York City. She's also part of the leadership team for the Independent Restaurant Coalition, which is a coalition of restaurants dedicated to saving the industry from the impacts of COVID-19. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, can you describe what your restaurant looked like and how it functioned before and how that's changed since the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, before we were a pretty typical restaurant. We had most of our seats inside. We had servers and it was sort of a fancier restaurant. We did a 10-course tasting menu that cost about, our check average was around $120 a person. And you know, it was like any other restaurant. It was loud, it was boisterous, it was fun. It's where you went to have good times, sometimes bad times. You broke up, you got back together. There was engagements, there was birthdays, there was anniversaries. Mm-hmm. It was a restaurant, and now it is something completely different. We don't have any indoor dining at all, even though in New York you can have 25%. We have built, an outdoor patio hut outside with heaters and electricity and lights, and we no longer do a 10-course tasting menu. We do a 3-course tasting menu, and then we do a lot of like sandwiches and salads, and we tried to become much more of a neighborhood restaurant. Before, we were certainly a destination restaurant. We really relied on tourists, which unfortunately there are no more of in New York City. So we've spent the last couple of months really trying to get to know our neighborhood, which has been great, actually. It's something we probably should have done earlier, and it's been good to get to know our neighbors, but it's been hard. You know, our check average is now $50 a person, and it feels like we've done this 180 pivot.
How much of a financial hit has your restaurant taken since the start of the pandemic?
I'm not even sure if I can like quantify it. You know, we're down, our business is down 75%. We used to make anywhere between $10,000 and $12,000 on a good night. And now we're around $2,500, maybe $3,000 on a really good night. It's a huge, huge difference and not really sustainable.
Well, so far, New York hasn't issued any new shutdown orders, but they have significantly upped the safety requirements for restaurants staying open. What are some of those requirements and how are they impacting your business?
Well, one of the problems that's happened in New York is they sort of keep rolling out the guidelines. We didn't get them all 6 months ago, which would have been a lot easier, I think, for any of us. And so I've rebuilt my patio now 3-4 times. We had a patio that during the summer you only needed to have an 8-inch barrier between you and the streets, and now they're telling us, well, that barrier has to be filled all the way with either soil or sandbags, and if as much as possible it should be removable so that, you know, when the snow trucks come down, it doesn't get in its way. And that's not something any of us can do this late in the game. I mean, there's no way I can move my patio. It has electricity in it. It just doesn't collapse and fold up.
What are you planning to do for the winter? Do you think you'll be able to keep that outdoor space in use?
I'm going to hope and dream and pray a lot for the winter. Yeah, we're going to keep the outdoor open as long as possible. I don't have any plans to do indoor dining. I personally don't think it's safe, and I don't want to put my staff at risk. So we're going to try to keep it open as long as possible. You know, right now it's 50 degrees in New York, and it's sustainable. People are still coming. I worry once we get down to the low 40s and, you know, closer to freezing, that our customers will choose to stay inside in their houses and not come out. But we're just going to, you know, keep adding blankets and as many heaters as we can.
Well, you wrote an op-ed in the New York Times at the beginning of the pandemic when you had to let go of your whole staff. What's happened with your staff since then?
Well, so I did. I let go of 35 staff members in mid-March, the hardest day of my entire career. And most of them are still not employed by me. I've hired back 6 employees. We've tried to keep our staffing numbers as low as possible so that we could be as safe as possible. We're all working sort of extra hard to make it work. But the more we introduce outsiders, the more risk there is of contracting the disease, and that just doesn't seem worth it. And I, you know, again, I want to keep my staff as safe as possible and my customers as safe as possible. And so the fewer number of people we can have in the restaurant on a daily basis, the better.
We're talking about how restaurants are planning for the winter during a global pandemic with Amanda Cohen. She's owner and chef of Dirt Candy in New York. Now, Amanda, you're part of this leadership team for the Independent Restaurant Coalition, which was formed in response to the pandemic. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing as part of this group.
Yeah, so this has been a pretty amazing group to work with. A bunch of chefs came together in mid-March and realized that this was going to be a long-term problem, that we were going to have a lot of issues. Closing down the restaurant industry across the country seemed almost impossible, and it seems impossible to at the time to reopen it, and we didn't know how long we were going to be shut down for, but 2 weeks didn't seem very likely. And also, none of us have enough money in our bank account really to be able to, you know, stay open without having any income whatsoever. So all the chefs got together from all around the country and all different kinds of restaurants, and decided that we had a voice and that we should use our voice. And, you know, we started looking at the numbers, and there's 500,000 independent restaurants in the states. We are the second biggest employer in the states. That's huge. We employ 16 million workers. And that means that we put a lot of money back into the economy, and that actually our voice is pretty powerful. And so we started lobbying Congress. The first thing we did was we lobbied to fix the PPP so that it could work better for restaurants. You know, at first it was only the amount of money was only for 8 weeks, and we really were like, well, most of our restaurants are even open at the end of 8 weeks, so we need to push that. We need to move it to at least 24 weeks. And that happened, and that was great. And the PPP was really a lifesaver for 24 weeks, but coming to the end of that 24 weeks, all of us looked around again and we're like, well, most of us still aren't open. And most of us, even if we are at open, are operating at, you know, half capacity or 25% capacity. And that's not sustainable. None of us will be able to be there at the end of this, you know, pandemic if we don't get more money, if we aren't somehow helped. And so then we started lobbying Congress again, and we have something called the Restaurant Act, which is passed in the House. We're waiting for it to pass in the Senate, and it's a grant for restaurants.
And that's a $120 billion relief grant program for restaurants. What happens if this plan can't get past the gridlock that currently exists in Congress?
Then the restaurants are going to close. We will all shut down. I mean, some will survive, but we're looking at massive closures. I mean, I've been around for 12 years. I'm pretty well known. I had a pretty robust business before I had to shut down, and I will not survive without the stimulus. There's just no way I can do this without the grant. I don't have enough money in my bank account. My rent has not been abated whatsoever. I won't be able to pay my employees, and I am not unique in this. Every other restaurateur is facing the same decisions. And that once we close, we won't reopen again. I think sort of for the long term, you know, when we close, those jobs are going to be lost for a very, very long time. We're talking about a huge number of people going back on unemployment and not being able to find work in the service industry, because the service industry will not exist. And then even bigger than that, there is a ripple effect. We employ, or, you know, we're part of like the farmers and the winemakers and the potterers. And, you know, once we go, there's not going to be any money going to them either. And you'll see farms closing and wineries closing. It will be a massive, massive blow to this country.
You know, Amanda, the restaurant business is one that has notoriously slim margins. On the other side of this pandemic, do you think there needs to be a reimagining of how restaurants operate?
I hope there will be a reimagining. I think we all realized that our industry was not sustainable. And I think we all knew that before we went into the pandemic. But we've all had some time to think it over. And, you know, one of the things we've all, I think, come to as a realization is we're not being good employers, and we're not being good business owners, because we don't have enough to weather a really bad storm. I'm not sure any restaurant anywhere could have weathered this. I mean, it's now gone on for 8 months, but even a month into it or 2 months into it, it was looking pretty bleak. You know, we have to start educating the customer more about how much it costs to dine in a restaurant. We have to start paying our employees more so they can have health insurance. And we need to be able to start paying ourselves more so we too can have health insurance. We just need to find a way to make it more sustainable. And that's, I think, a good thing that's going to come out of this. Finally, chefs around the country and restaurateurs are talking to each other, which is not something that's happened like this beforehand.
That's Amanda Cohen. She's owner and chef of Dirt Candy. That's a vegetarian restaurant in New York City. She's also part of the leadership team for the Independent Restaurant Coalition. Amanda, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, we're heading into the holiday seasons, and for many of us, that would normally mean spending time with family and friends, heading home. But a closer look at the spike in COVID cases as we head into the holidays means maybe we need to rethink those plans. And some of you are sounding a bit relieved. One person from our text club says, "My family will give thanks in our own individual homes this year and will get together by way of Zoom or FaceTime. No need to go crazy with house cleaning or waking up at 5 a.m. to prepare the feast this year." Well, we'll hear from an epidemiologist and a psychologist about how to navigate this really challenging time when you want to be with family and friends. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. Hey, it's holiday. I got foes on foes and they out of control, yo. Hey, it's another way. All my head doesn't go and I hope that you know it. I can't even close my eyes. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. As we head into winter, the U.S. is seeing a surge in coronavirus cases and now in coronavirus deaths. The last 2 weeks in particular have seen an 82% jump in new cases. What should we expect as we head into the holidays and as more people lose the outdoor spaces they've come to rely on? To talk us through the wintertime pandemic blues, we're joined by Saskia Popescu. She's an infectious disease epidemiologist at George Mason University. Saskia, welcome back.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And Val Wright, a licensed psychologist and senior director of healthcare innovation at the American Psychological Association. Val, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
We also want to hear from you. How are you planning to deal with the winter weather as COVID restrictions tighten up? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. Well, Saskia, let's start with the numbers. What are we seeing right now in terms of cases?
Well, really what we're seeing across the United States is unprecedented. It's very uncontrolled growth. So for yesterday, there were 148,000 daily cases, and we have over 73,000 people hospitalized. Deaths are climbing, and the truth is that this is the first we've seen it so bad in the pandemic, and that's extremely worrisome. So I think one thing that's particularly concerning is hospitalizations and deaths are very much a lagging indicator. So if you think about the fact that yesterday we had 148,000 new people diagnosed with COVID-19, in the coming weeks, that will likely translate to an increase in hospitalizations and potentially even deaths. So with hospitals very much already stressed in several states like Illinois, Texas, Indiana, Minnesota, what's worrisome is that this is likely going to get worse, and throwing the holidays and the winter months into that is deeply worrisome.
What do we know about why we're seeing such a surge in cases right now?
I don't think there's one particular reason. I think it's several things. During the colder months, we move indoors, which is higher risk. So that's one piece to this. I think people are also really suffering pandemic fatigue. You know, we're 11 months into this. Everybody wants some sense of normalcy. And what I have generally seen, and this kind of palpable, feeling in the air when I've been traveling or just out and about, is that people are kind of over it. They want a sense of normalcy, and COVID-19 in their mind is going to be with us for a while. So why not have that sense of normalcy? And unfortunately, that means we're seeing very significant outbreaks related to events like weddings that we know are just high risk and shouldn't be happening. So I think it's all of these factors working together.
Vale, like Saskia says, this is something we're hearing a lot about, that people are just tired of this. They want to see their friends and family. Some people think it's not really that big of a deal. How can people combat that COVID fatigue?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, you know, our emotions really drive our behavior. And so when fatigue is the thing driving our behavior, we have a tendency to become complacent. And it makes it that much harder to do the right thing or the hard thing, like wearing masks and maintaining our physical distance from others. I think that it really comes down to thinking about it in a different mindset, as instead of it feeling like something's being taken away from us, approaching it as, this is our role as citizens, this is our role as members of our own community to protect each other and protect ourselves, and that really it's an altruistic act. And if we can all kind of come together, more like how we did at the beginning in the spring, then we're much more likely to get a quicker end to what we're seeing.
Well, Saskia, it doesn't help that some national figures are playing down the pandemic, including some on the president's own coronavirus task force. Dr. Scott Atlas recently tweeted that residents of Michigan should, quote, rise up against COVID protection orders. As an epidemiologist, when you see messaging like that, how do you react?
Unfortunately, this isn't the first time, and it's something we've been battling this entire pandemic. I think we're all tired, we're exhausted, and then to have national leaders and these large public figures making comments like that, inciting violence in some ways and belittling the amount of pain and suffering that's going on, is it's so heartbreaking. And honestly, I think frustration is the only term I can really use to describe it, but more so the fact that, you know, we've also seen some gaslighting from the president and from several people on his staff saying, well, you know, doctors are making more money off of COVID patients, which is simply not true. So to gaslight the hard work of healthcare workers and public health is just mind-blowing to me. And considering that we have not really gotten a break, we're all very exhausted, and now we're in this unprecedented, very concerning third wave that is just continuously climbing, is something that I really didn't expect, and unfortunately something that is making it a lot worse. And, you know, I think we could all use a break from it, honestly.
Well, and Vale, what kind of an impact does that kind of messaging have on Americans who are already struggling to do something they don't want to do?
Yeah, it has an incredibly detrimental impact. We really do look to our leaders to provide clear, consistent, science-based information, and clearly we're not seeing that. And so when you see not just the mis-messaging with the words, but then the pictures that go along with it, right? Someone's saying wear a mask, but then they're not wearing one themselves. It really creates a challenging situation, because in the face of uncertainty, we tend to seek out information on how to handle it. And when that information is conflicting or downright incorrect, then that, of course, will have a negative impact on the way in which we act.
A lot of the messaging about not following COVID health measures has been coded in these emotional terms. You know, I won't live in fear. I'm strong. You're weak. It's not real anyway. We got this post from Noah on Facebook who says, I can't wait to have Thanksgiving dinner with my family. Although we realize the reality of COVID-19, no one chooses to live in fear and be forced to distance from our loved ones. Talk about this sort of emotional argument that people sometimes have in their heads, equating what is a public health emergency with living in fear.
Yeah, so fear gets a bad rap. Fear is not exactly a bad thing. It does motivate us to protect ourselves when we're under threat. And the reality is that there is a threat, and that threat is invisible, which makes it even more challenging. And for a lot of people, even though the numbers are rising, as we've talked about, there's still a lot of people in this country who don't know somebody who's either contracted COVID or died from COVID. I think that's going to change, and some of the ways that could help is once we have a personal experience with something, it becomes more real and people may take it more seriously. So it's, again, the narrative of somehow living in fear as a bad thing. It's not that you're living in fear. You are accurately recognizing that there is a significant threat. Obviously, hopefully you're making appropriate risk-benefit analyses about, you know, what's safe and what's less safe. And then, again, reframing it as this is you being a citizen. This is part of our responsibility as citizens in a democratic society to take care of ourselves and take care of others.
Is there also something at work where psychologically it feels like if we are with people we know, our family, our friends, that somehow that's safer than being with strangers, even though that's not necessarily the case?
Sure. I mean, you know, as humans, we all need people, and social connection is really important, even particularly during times of stress. And often we, I think of our friends as family as being safer. We trust that they're maybe engaging in the behaviors that we're also engaging in, and so therefore they can't get it. They won't get it, so we won't get it. But we're not really thinking about that our bubble is not just our bubble. Our bubble is actually our bubble plus our friend's bubble and who they're seeing, and then their friend's bubble as well. And so, you know, again, even though, you know, engaging with people in your smallest bubble, your household is probably safer than strangers, it's still nothing is 100% safe.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about preparing for a COVID winter with Vale Wright, a licensed psychologist and senior director of healthcare innovation at American Psychological Association. Also with us, Saskia Popescu, an infectious disease epidemiologist at George Mason University. We're also hearing from you. Chris tweets, "My brother and I both left the military in the last 18 months. This year was to be the first Christmas I would be home with my whole family since 2009. What's one more year? The health of my family and friends is more important." And John posted on Facebook, "When did we become a nation of infants? So you can't get together for Thanksgiving. Deal with it. Think about other people for a change and wear the dang mask." Vale, how do you think the winter will impact people, especially as outdoor spaces become less available?
Yeah, I really think that we've seen the outdoors as a respite up to this point. You know, it is a place where the virus is less likely to spread, or it's a little bit safer. You can engage in sort of socially distanced walks or, you know, engagements with friends. And, you know, as it starts to get colder and the days start to get darker, I do worry that that could have a negative impact. What we've been telling people is really to start planning for that now and think about how can you maximize your time both outside and getting, you know, sunlight and, you know, using what you can to maintain those social connections as we start to head into the winter.
And what guidance do you have for people, especially if they're feeling isolated and stuck? Are there things we can do to sort of maybe change our thinking about where we are in this moment?
Yeah, I think for, you know, during the spring, it was a hard pivot, right, to figuring out how to work from home if you were lucky enough to do so, how to e-learn your kids, how to even get groceries. And now we've got those routines down and most of those questions answered. Now it really becomes a time to sit, calm down, and reflect. Reflect on what is most critical to you right now. Where do your values lie? How can you, knowing and recognizing that this is the quote-unquote new normal for a while, how can you make a life worth living? How can you make it meaningful even in this truly, as we said before, unprecedented situation? And then act in alignment with those values and those core beliefs that are important to you.
Now, Saskia, what guidance are you giving people right now to make sure they keep themselves and their community safe?
Well, I think the guidance is still the same in terms of risk reduction being really additive. It's not just one measure, right? It's that Swiss cheese approach. So the masking, the distancing, good ventilation, hand hygiene, et cetera. But for the holidays, you know, as we've already discussed, I really do like explaining that this is not going to look like previous holidays, and that's okay. That means that we are taking the measures that are needed to help reduce COVID-19 transmission. So that there are opportunities to kind of embrace these changes a little bit, there are ways that we can still have a holiday without increasing risk for other people. And it's, you know, it's not just doing something outside, it's all of these measures together. There's a lot of Zoom or electronic ways we can do this too, but also having those conversations about, do you want to pod with another family, another household, and what that really truly means, the work that goes into it. But that might be something that's worthwhile for some people. So I do 100% agree. Having those conversations early and really explaining what this is going to look like is so important right now.
Well, we're getting some creative solutions from 1A people. A member of our text club says, "I'm in quarantine in my art studio in the desert. My family, who are in a pod together in Chicago, will put my Zoom head at the table for Thanksgiving." That's not too creepy, right? It absolutely is not. Saskia, at the beginning of the pandemic, we saw an overwhelmed healthcare system. And as you said, cases are now climbing again. Hospitals are beginning to once again run out of beds. If we continue on the path we're on right now, what will that mean for hospitals and healthcare workers?
Well, unfortunately, I think it means what many of us are fearing, that we're going to have hospitals that are extremely overwhelmed, full ICUs, full hospitals, and having to build field hospitals, which we did in the very beginning. So that is very possible. But one of the resources we don't spend enough time talking about, you know, while we discuss things like personal protective equipment or PPE, ventilators, medications, et cetera, is healthcare workers. They're a finite resource and they're tired. You know, and I don't just mean healthcare workers, also public health personnel, but realistically, this is not a resource we can just build more of. So I think as we look into these winter months and this pandemic getting worse, one of the things that we're most concerned about isn't just the availability of hospital beds, but also if we have healthcare workers that are strained, get sick themselves. You know, this is typically a very busy time of year actually for hospitals, influenza, respiratory virus season. This is our busiest season. So you add that to COVID-19 and an already stressed workforce. It's very, very challenging for us to maintain these levels of readiness, and especially if it gets worse.
Well, a member of our 1A text club writes, "Our small family gathering is still on, but only because my family is completely quarantining, working from home and doing online groceries. But that's making me feel really conflicted because it means somebody else is taking the risk on our behalf. My parents are in the vulnerable category, but so are a lot of grocery workers, and they don't have a choice." I mean, Saskia, talk about that, because when we've been talking about essential workers during this pandemic, there's been, rightfully so, a lot of focus on healthcare workers, but they're also the people who make it possible for folks like me to have groceries delivered to my house, and talk about the strain it's putting on them.
Entirely. And I think that is one thing that we've really learned through this pandemic, that essential workers are not just limited to frontline responders and healthcare workers. There is an entire workforce of people that are making things safer for us to stay home. And it is so important that we ensure that they are protected and that they have the means and the education and the skills to protect themselves too. So, of course, as we move into this more and more and people are shifting and leaning in towards ordering things from home or perhaps directing their attention elsewhere, we need to make sure that these people are protected, that they're given masks and resources. And I honestly think a big piece to this is community education and ensuring that they know what risk reduction looks like and how they can be safe, during this work and what that means. One thing that I always see is actually people ordering things from home, opening the door to get the groceries or whatever it might be from, you know, the delivery person, and they're not wearing the mask. The delivery person has been wonderful wearing a mask, using hand hygiene, but the person at home isn't. And I think little things like that are such important things that we can do to make their job safer.
We got this tweet from Shanna who says, "I live in a rural community that largely doesn't believe COVID is a big deal. I feel like I am carrying the load for them and like I'm being judged for my caution. I'm tired." Vale, any guidance for Shanna about how she can continue to try to protect herself and others, even though she feels like there's a lot of pressure on her and she's exhausted?
Yeah, it's tough when you feel like you're the only one taking something seriously. The role of social influence in risk reduction is huge, right? If you're the only person wearing a mask on the train, you feel weird. If you're the only person not wearing the mask on the train, you feel weird, right? That influence of the social influence. I think, you know, it comes a bit down to resolve, you know, reminding herself that, you know, she's doing this for a reason, to protect herself, to protect others. And then reminding herself of what's in her control. The judgment that she might feel from others is not something she has any control over. And so if you can kind of remind yourself to let that go and to just focus on what is in your control. So the things that you're doing, the ways in which you're taking care of yourself, the ways in which you're actually giving back to your community in meaningful ways, even if others don't recognize it. Holding on to those aspects and those values, and even maybe just writing them down, keeping them in a journal, writing down a gratitude journal, just again to remind yourself of why you're doing exactly what you're doing.
That's Vale Wright. She's a licensed psychologist and senior director of healthcare innovation at American Psychological Association. Also with us, Saskia Popescu, infectious disease epidemiologist at George Mason University. In a moment, what do the holidays look like in a pandemic? I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment. It's been a stressful and largely isolating year, and some are hoping to find respite in the tradition and comfort of the holidays. But how can you have a safe celebration, and what does a pandemic holiday even look like? Our guests today are Saskia Popescu, an infectious disease epidemiologist at George Mason University, and Vale Wright, licensed psychologist and senior director of healthcare innovation at American Psychological Association. We're also talking to you. A member of our text club says, we're retaining our four family neighborhood Friendsgiving, but this year we're doing it in a three-car garage with each family at their own table. We may be eating in puffy coats with hats and gloves. Now, Saskia, some people may be struggling with the expectation for a family gathering. Dr. Fauci says he'll be Zooming this year with his family. What are you telling people about staying safe during the holidays this year? Is that member of our text club, is that a good plan to have it out in a garage with people at separate tables?
I definitely think that's a good idea. Anything you can do outside is preferred, but being outdoors does not eliminate risk. So if you're going to have another household with you or another family with you, having separate tables outside and being distance, wearing your masks when you're interacting with them is definitely helpful. But it is important to note, though, just because you're outside doesn't mean that you can be at the same table. So you definitely want to still do things like that. I think the biggest takeaway is that any additional people outside of your little household do increase risk. So it's important to really have those conversations if that's something that you're willing to take on, if you have vulnerable people in your household or within that household. And if you are going to have people over and you're doing those separate tables outside, I think that's wonderful. But have those conversations about the expectations for safety when they come over, that they're wearing masks until they're seated at their table eating, and that, you know, everybody's going to stay outside. You're not going to suddenly start wandering inside to have cocktails or anything like that. So part of this is having those important conversations and setting rules, expectations, and transparency is really important, because we want this to be a happy event, and you can still do this over Zoom. I think that's going to be the safest approach. But if you are opting to see other people, keep it small, keep it outdoors, and really make sure you're separated and masked.
Well, another member of our text club says, I made the tough decision to cancel Thanksgiving with my relatives in Flint, Michigan this year. Equally disappointing is that I will spend the holidays alone, as I have no mate, children, or pets. I sincerely hope that we are not in this situation at the same time next year. You know, Vale, I think a lot of us are just longing for familiar traditions and rituals in a year where so many things have been unusual. What do rituals mean for our lives?
Yeah, rituals really, they provide an anchor, right, to, again, what's important to us. You know, rituals are usually around our values, whether that's family or friends or, you know, some sort of aspect of our pasts. And so it's a time to reflect, usually, and it has that kind of nostalgic component to it, reminding us of times in the past when maybe things were a little bit easier. They're not that important for everybody, but for those where it is, you know, I think what we need to do is, again, as we've been talking about, changing our mindset. So in looking at this year, this holiday, is not as something being taken away, but as an opportunity to try something new, to start a new ritual, or to honor an old ritual in a new way.
Well, we have Leanne here from Texas, who shared her holiday plans.
The way that we are preparing for this Thanksgiving holiday is that our small group of seven people have decided to quarantine 2 weeks prior to getting together for Thanksgiving. Quarantining meaning only going out for the essentials. And then we will all get together and have a fabulous Thanksgiving holiday together.
Now, Saskia, Leanne is quarantining for 2 weeks before. Is this a safe way to go to the holidays when getting together with family?
I think that's a safe first step. So the important thing is, when we're discussing going out for essentials, what does that mean? It can mean various things to different people. So part of potting or quarantine potting, as we've been calling it, with another family is to understand our risk perception and how we're each approaching that. Quarantining for 14 days is really helpful, but part of this is also, have you developed COVID-19 during that time frame? So I always encourage people, if you are going to quarantine for 14 days, get tested towards the tail end of that so that you will know when you leave your quarantine, if you have, you know, developed COVID-19 during this time. So I think that's a wonderful first step, but there's a lot of other pieces to this. Just like testing is not an end-all be-all, quarantining is great, but you still need to be safe during that time frame. So one thing I do worry about and I see frequently is, you know, people opting to quarantine because they want to see their family, but then during that time going to the grocery store and, you know, still running a lot of errands that they deem as essential that really should be done through delivery and other means.
Well, there's also a lot of discussion about what a small group really means. We have people saying small group, but that could mean anything from 3 people to, you know, 15 people or anything in between. How would you define a small group?
That's such a great question. You know, in California, they say no more than 10 people. And what worries me is that could be 5 households of 2 people. So I think really, truly, the fewer, the better. I really look at this as what is the size of the household you're interacting with and what are their risk factors? Do they have children that are in school? Is somebody at risk for severe disease? So there's no magic number. You know, I think 10 has been one we've leaned on because it's something tangible we can point towards. But realistically, I like to keep it just myself and one other household. And that means, you know, are we cognizant that the children are in school? Does somebody travel a lot for work? All of those things that we really need to account for.
Well, we also got this tweet from Amanda in D.C. who says, I'm doing a Thanksgiving pod with a few friends. We all agreed to isolate before, but 2 people have housemates who don't subscribe to our rules. Now I keep thinking about household transmission. Risk calculation sucks. So it's part of the issue is that your group may agree to something, but if people have roommates or other family members, or if they're going into an office and they have coworkers who don't share that same concern, is there really any way to completely safely figure out what the risk is for your pod?
There have been some really wonderful resources online about this. I think one of the biggest conversations or one of the biggest things we can do is having a conversation about the risk factors in each other's lives and meaning the differences in the households. Some of that is, what is the work that you do? You know, what are your activities when you're engaging with coworkers? But also picking some activities and each of you independently ranking them on where they fall in your risk awareness so that you see if somebody considers grocery shopping really high risk, but going to a restaurant low risk, that might be the opposite for you. And what does that really mean and how you're deciding to pod with them? So I do think having those conversations about who people interact with, especially if they have roommates, you know, if you're trying to pod or quarantine with somebody that has roommates, you're also really podding and quarantining with those roommates. And if they are not going to be a part of this, that's really not an effective bubble.
Well, Saskia, after the show, I'd love to get some of those resources from you so we can share them on our social media with folks. We got this tweet from Brian who says, my mother is nearly religious about having all her children visit on Christmas Day, but I'm seriously willing to suffer an expletive-filled conversation rather than endanger her health and the health of my siblings. And Val, we've heard from a lot of people who are struggling to be the first to say no or cancel plans that their family's putting together. What advice do you have for people who need to take that leap?
Yeah, it's really about approaching those conversations with a good plan ahead of time and using your most effective communication skills. So it's about coming in, being firm but polite, and sticking to your guns and not swaying, you know, if on the other end they, you know, try to give you a guilt trip or they're, you know, appropriately disappointed. Because really at the end of the day, you have to stay true to how you want to protect your family. And that includes, you know, your mother on the other end. You know, my brother comes down for Thanksgiving every year, and this year he's not because he doesn't want to put my 85-year-old mom at risk. And he was the first one to say it, and I'm sure that that was hard, but you know, at the end of the day, like we've been talking about, I don't think we'll have to make these kinds of conversations next year. I think this is one Thanksgiving, one holiday season. We can create new memories and new traditions and, you know, keep each other safe.
We also got this text that says, we are isolating now, so when we gather again, no one is missing. Everyone in our family agrees a turkey dinner is not worth a potential death. And for Christmas, we have postponed until next July. We will literally have our Christmas in July. We're talking about preparing for the holiday season amid a pandemic with Saskia Popescu, an infectious disease epidemiologist at George Mason University, and Vail Wright, a licensed psychologist and senior director of healthcare innovation at American Psychological Association. Well, we got this voicemail. This is Kate from North Carolina sharing her concerns for the holidays.
My husband and I both have family out of state, and I think what we're most worried about for the holidays is setting expectations for what everybody is comfortable with and what makes us feel safe, and then the unexpected tension of people maybe not following through, or not everybody getting the message, or people just deciding, oh, I'm just going to hug you anyway, or I don't really need a mask, and what that's going to be like, and do we stick up for ourselves and risk hurting people's feelings?
So Vail, Kate's asking a question here about setting boundaries with people who you love, who you care about, who may have different expectations and standards than you do. Any advice for her?
Yeah, it's about, you know, having, again, clear communication ahead of time about what the expectations are for mask wearing, for maintaining physical distance, for how you're going to interact, and then rules for what happens if somebody breaks that. And then you have to follow through on those rules. So if somebody does break it and everybody had agreed that that meant we were all going home, then you've got to go home. You know, even if it's hurting somebody else's feelings. Their feelings are, you're not responsible for their feelings, particularly if the expectations have been set from the start. You have to, again, stick to your guns and to your values and protecting yourself and your family.
Here's Regina from Chicago talking about her struggle with the holidays.
What I'm dealing with this holiday season is that I live alone, and I feel like everyone has forgotten that there are a lot of people who live alone, and we can't just celebrate with those in our household. We can't just not invite any guests over and not be a guest in anyone's home and still feel like we're a part of Thanksgiving or a part of Christmas Day.
Saskia, any thoughts for our single household friends? Is there a safe way for Regina to still be next to another human being this Thanksgiving?
So I do think that corn pod is a great idea. Podding with another individual or household safely and through all those measures we've discussed. But one thing that I also really did like that was recommended, not just for Thanksgiving, but also, you know, Christmas and Hanukkah, was doing a contactless drop-off of food or gifts and then Zooming together to open them and eat them together. I really love that concept because that way you're still all eating the same food, you're still getting to watch each other open gifts, and you're having that connection in a safe way. So there are ways to do this. I think the biggest piece is just, you know, if you decide to pod with somebody else because you just want someone around, and I entirely agree and support that. Again, having those conversations, I just shared some resources with you. So part of that too is, you know, really asking those questions if this person is comfortable being safe and taking all these measures with you, because our desire for human interaction is so important, but we also need to do it in a safe way.
Well, Maggie points out tests won't help if you've just been infected, since the virus needs to replicate in your body for up to 4 days before a test can show you are positive. So Saskia, for people who are, you know, quarantining, isolating for, you know, 14 days, and you recommended them getting a test at the end of that period of time, how should they think about test results, especially if they're traveling to another place?
Yeah, so what I definitely encourage people to do is, so example, if you're traveling, you should take the time to quarantine when you get there, because it's not just a matter of the travel being the exposure, but what if your exposure happened before you traveled? So definitely plan out that time to quarantine when you get there. I encourage people to test around day 10 or 11. That's when we're seeing about 97% of people, if they're going to be positive, turn positive. Again, that's 97%. There's still a little window right there, but you still need to go the full 14 days. But that is an important piece. And if you are going to travel, there's a lot of safety mechanisms you need to build into it. Wearing a mask the entire time, trying to avoid eating and drinking when you're around others, driving if possible is always a good idea. So there are all of these things we need to consider, which is really stressful and exhausting. And I think that's part of the reason we're seeing pandemic fatigue. But now more than ever, with the data that we're seeing across the United States, it's so important we take the time to do this.
Well, Kenneth tweets, I really wish that the term social distancing had not been adopted as the standard at the start of this pandemic. It emphasizes, almost mandates, psychological isolation. What we need is physical distancing with social interaction by other clever means that we humans can devise. Just as we wrap up here really quickly, Vail, you know, any advice for people about how to rethink this feeling that, you know, this term we use, social distancing, means that we have to be socially isolated from one another.
Yeah, we at APA have actually had the exact same thought, that we wished it hadn't been called that, and we've been trying really hard to use the term physically distancing, because at the end of the day, social connection is a critically important way to buffer stress and reduce isolation and loneliness. The extent to which we can reframe that in our minds and prioritize how can I safely maintain social connections, obviously a lot of that is virtual right now, but I think we need to start being more creative and almost look at this as if we're in a long-distance romantic relationship. What would you do there? You would send notes, and you would send gifts, and, you know, you would find other ways to maintain connection, and I think we need to be doing that with our families, with our friends, with our coworkers, with everybody, because, again, at the end of the day, we are all in this together, and we're only going to get through it together.
That's Vail Wright, a licensed psychologist and senior director of healthcare innovation at American Psychological Association. Also with us, Saskia Popescu, an infectious disease epidemiologist at George Mason University. Thanks to you both for joining us today. Remember, we have a text club. We'll only ever send you one text a day. It's the fastest way to connect with us. Details about how to sign up can be found in the Ask 1A tab at the1a.org. Today's producer was Michelle Harvin. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.